Doctor Who, Short Trips, Time Tunnel, by Nigel Fairs, read by Katie Manning.
Doctor, what on earth have you done to my transistor radio?
For a moment, there was no reply. Then the TARDIS door creaked open and a familiar shock of white hair emerged.
Ah, that,
he said, rubbing the back of his neck as he walked over to the workbench.
Yes, well, you see, Joe,
Yes, Doctor?
Joe stood, hands on hips, eyebrows raised, trying not to smile. The doctor's eyes twinkled back apologetically.
I thought it might be rather useful.
Joe picked up the radio set, now a mess of exposed wires and valves, and held it out towards him.
How exactly? She asked. I probably couldn't work out how to turn it on now, let alone listen to the hip parade.
The doctor took it from her and turned it in his hands, adjusting a wire here, nudging a peculiar metal switch or an oddly glowing panel there.
Well, it's not actually supposed to be a listening device now,
he explained.
Well, not primarily, anyway. More of a recording device.
Jo felt curious, despite herself.
Recording device? But where do I put the cassette tape?
He stopped fiddling and produced something rather like a small piece of shining cardboard.
Doesn't need one, not with this.
And what's that?
Joe asked.
A digital chip, the doctor explained. I found it in a bag a couple of days ago, in the TARDIS. This one, in fact.
He gestured towards a dusty carpet bag at his feet.
And where does it go? Your chip, I mean.
The doctor peered into the mass of wires, then smiled up at Joe.
Well, that's it, you see. I'm not entirely sure.
They laughed. The lab door opened and the brigadier strode into the room with a brown folder full of papers.
Doctor?
He began, then stopped as Joe's radio started humming ominously.
What on earth's that?
It used to be my transistor radio, Joe whispered. But now it's a cassette recorder. Powered by chips.
There was a resounding bleep from the device. The doctor smiled in satisfaction, placed it on the workbench, and sat back in his chair. The brigadier opened his mouth to speak, but stopped when the doctor held a finger up to his own mouth. The device clicked.
By chips, by chips, by chips,
it repeated, Joe's voice scratchy and distorted. Then it gave out a small fut. And a trail of smoke rose from one of the dials. The doctor frowned.
Very impressive, Doctor,
the brigadier sighed.
Now then, if I could possibly distract you from your tinkering, I had a report that might interest you.
The doctor didn't reply. He picked up the smoking device and was rearranging singed wires within it.
What is it, Brigadier?
Joe asked.
There's a crisis down in Sussex,
he replied, trying not to betray any weariness about this game that the doctor insisted on playing on an almost daily basis.
Trains coming out of a railway tunnel, a driver and all the passengers dead.
Oh, that's horrible, said Joe.
The brigadier nodded.
The emergency services and the regular army are handling things for the moment, but we need to find out exactly what's going on as soon as possible, before the press starts seeing through the military exercises cover story. All it takes is for one of the passengers' relatives to talk to the papers and the whole place will be swarming with... Doctor, are you listening to me?
With a slightly louder fuck, the doctor's device let out another puff of smoke. And finally, the doctor dropped it into his carpet bag, exasperated. He looked up with a broad smile.
Right, Brigadier. What can I do for you? Something about railways, wasn't it?
Wow!
Joe gasped as Bessie rounded a corner at speed.
Doctor, look at that!
Two huge dark slices of rock rose before them, like a pair of fists raised towards the bright autumnal sky. Trees sprouted incongruously from the base of them both, all leaning outwards, as if centuries ago they'd been parted by the rocks as they shot upwards. But most incongruous of all was a castle-like structure that manacled the fists together, its walls and windows black with dirt, its crenellations worn with age.
It's a bit like Peladon,
Joe remarked.
Except for the railway tunnel, Joe.
She looked again and saw that the castle was only one story high, its lower half straddling a large hole in the rock face, presumably the railway tunnel that they were here to investigate. A shiver ran down Joe's spine as Bessie sped on past the tunnel's mouth and into the village.
No, said Captain Yates 10 minutes later, handing her a very welcome cup of tea.
It's not really a castle. It isn't even a real house, just a folly put up there in the 19th century, apparently, by a local landowner called Lord William Douglas.
UNIT had commandeered the village school, transforming the gymnasium into a makeshift mortuary, and this, one of the classrooms, into an officer's mess. The regulation teacup seemed oversized on the school desk, and Captain Yates was positively giant-like as he perched on a tiny, bright orange chair.
You know a lot about it, Joe teased him.
The brigadier sent me to recce the village as soon as we got here, he explained. The woman who runs the post office is a fount of knowledge. Did you see those two rocks above the tunnel?
We could hardly miss them,
Joe replied, shuddering. She took a sip of tea.
They're called the Devil's Splinters. The story goes that Satan was trapped under a huge rockfall for a century or two, and when he finally managed to punch his way out, he did it with so much force that he split the hill in two. Colourful stuff. And then there's a bunch of nutcases complaining about a new reservoir they're building on the other side of the hill. They say it's going to wake up old Nick.
Joe's eyes widened, remembering Devil's End.
You don't think...
No,
Yates reassured her.
The nutcases, like I say, they haven't even got the legend right, have they? Old Nick woke up centuries ago. It's just an old folk story. Nothing to worry about.
He paused.
Unlike the business with the tunnel, that's got all the experts well and truly stumped.
Which is why the doctor's here, said Joe.
Captain Yates nodded, then stood to attention as the brigadier entered the classroom.
Ah, there you are, Miss Grant. Doctor has asked me to fetch his, what did he call it? Spectral something. He left it in that car of his, apparently. To be honest, I haven't a clue what he's talking about, so...
I'll fetch it, Joe smiled, walking towards the door.
No need for that,
the brigadier snapped before adding in a gentler tone.
If you could show Captain Yates where it is, he'll take it to the mortuary for you. Not the kind of place for a young woman, if you get my meaning.
That's very kind of you, Brigadier, Joe replied. But I'll be perfectly all right, thank you.
She stepped out into the rapidly cooling evening air and instantly regretted her bravado. She'd seen dead bodies before, of course, but 200 of them? Captain Yates had already told her that everyone had been under strict instructions not to touch the corpses, so they'd probably still be dressed. But even so, she took a deep breath, walked across the playground to Bessie and leant over the back seat where the doctor had tossed the carpet bag, saying that it would probably be useful. She picked it up and, mustering all her courage, walked towards the gym.
They died of malnutrition, all of them,
the doctor announced a little while later.
Meaning?
Asked the brigadier.
Meaning they starved to death. I know what malnutrition means, Doctor, the brigadier sighed. I mean, what does that tell us? How could they possibly all have died of starvation?
Were they in some sort of sect, perhaps, Captain Yates suggested. They did look a bit like hippies.
Well, the men anyway. You know, long hair, beards.
I noticed that, Joe said.
It was the first time she'd managed to talk. The doctor glanced across at her, concerned. She smiled back to reassure him and then continued.
But there was something wrong with them, apart from the fact that they were all dead, I mean. None of their clothes fitted. They were all too big. Even the driver's uniform was a size too large. And if the passengers were hippies, they were very strange ones. All in suits and ties.
What are you suggesting?
The brigadier asked.
I really don't know, Joe confessed. Maybe someone changed all their clothes.
Or swapped the bodies, the doctor suggested. I don't suppose you've thought to check that the passengers you took off the train are the same ones that got on at the beginning of the journey?
The brigadier blanched.
Yates!
He barked. Captain Yates nodded and left the room. The doctor lifted Joe's transistor radio out of the carpet bag and twisted it in his hand, lost in thought.
Surely that would have been a huge operation, Doctor,
the brigadier said.
According to the chappie from British Rail, the train was only a couple of minutes late coming out of the tunnel.
The doctor nodded, then stood pocketing the radio as Benton came in.
Well, Sergeant, he asked.
Everything's sorted, Doctor, Benton replied. They'll be turning on the electricity in 20 minutes. I'll take you to the station now, if you like.
No need for that. I can get there quicker in Bessie.
The doctor was about to leave when the brigadier snapped,
Just a minute, Doctor! Where do you think you're going?
For a train ride,
he beamed.
You're what? Joe gasped, standing. But, Doctor...
I shall be perfectly all right, Joe,
he reassured her, laying a hand on her shoulder. The brigadier seemed immensely put out.
On whose authority are you doing this?
He bristled.
I was told they closed the line indefinitely.
Friends in high places, brigadier.
The doctor smiled, tapping his nose.
And Sergeant Benton's brother works on the railways.
Benton grinned, but then stopped as his commanding officer shot him a disapproving glare. Joe picked up the doctor's carpet bag.
Right then, we better take this, just in case, she suggested.
The doctor shook his head.
I'm afraid you're not coming, Joe.
When she protested, he added,
You saw the state of the passengers. If they were the passengers, I can't risk the same thing happening to you. Oh, don't look so worried. I'm made of quite stern stuff, you know. And I've got the best train driver I know.
Who might that be?
The brigadier demanded.
Me.
Jo pulled her coat around her, shivering in the cold night air. Glancing at her watch again, she saw that it was nearly midnight. Any moment now, the train would be approaching the tunnel's southern entrance. If everything went to plan, it would emerge below the Devil's Splinters 4 minutes later. If everything went to plan.
Why did we let him do this, Mike?
She asked Captain Yates, who raised a rueful eyebrow and replied,
Once the doctor's decided to do something, it's nigh well impossible to stop him.
I know, but even so...
The rocks were pitch black now against a clear night sky. Away from London, with no light pollution to hide them, the stars shone brightly. Sometimes it seemed impossible to Joe that she had walked on worlds out there, breathed alien air, seen creatures and landscapes of almost unimaginable beauty. Looking up at the Devil's Splinters now, they seemed as ominously alien as some of those distant planets. Although Joe had been horrified by Mike's news about the passengers, that they were indeed the same people that had boarded the train that morning, it had made the doctor even more determined to carry out his investigation. Seeing her horror and the brigadier's exasperation, he had assured them both that he would be perfectly all right and that on no account was anyone to join him on the train. At exactly midnight, Yates's walkie-talkie crackled into life, and Benton announced that the doctor had entered the tunnel.
Roger,
Mike answered, then called across to the brigadier.
He's in, sir!
Yes, Yates, I heard,
the brigadier replied, striding across to stand beside them, his breath clouding in the air.
4 minutes,
he muttered. They felt like the longest 4 minutes of Joe's life. Nobody said a word. The wind in the trees seemed to stop. There wasn't even the distant murmur of traffic. It was as if the whole world was holding its breath. And then there came the hiss of electricity on the line. The sound of wheels clattering over points echoed from deep within the hill. A light emerged, tentatively at first, then slicing triumphantly through the darkness. The train came out of the tunnel, not smoothly, but shuddering, its brakes squealing, the engines rattling, finally quivering to a halt as the last carriage was inches away from the entrance. For a moment, nobody moved, cooling wheels hissing up at them from the dark carriages. Then Joe stumbled down the embankment towards the engine, followed by two soldiers, both of them shouting warnings as she hauled herself up onto the small step outside the driver's cabin. Wiping a layer of grime away from the window with her sleeve, she stared in at the motionless figure slumped over the controls.
Doctor!
She ventured, and then again more urgently.
Doctor!
The following morning, Mike Yates masterfully resisted the temptation to loosen his tie by inwardly repeating the lines his father had drummed into him as a boy. Excellent training for those long hours standing to attention on a parade ground in the height of summer or in the depths of winter. Tiger, tiger, burning bright, in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? He could never have foreseen that a career in the army would have led him into a battle not against Germans or Russians, but tentacled monsters and furious robot creatures. Or that he would be here, in the boiler room below a carpet factory in deepest Sussex, sweatily standing guard over a two-hearted alien who professed to be thousands of years old. Looking down at the doctor, Mike reflected that for once, with the beard, the motionless lined face, the huge mane of untidy white hair splayed out across the pillow, he actually looked old, ancient even. The sight of him in the driver's cab, his face caked in a glistening layer of ice, had been shocking to say the least. Both Mike and the brig had feared the worst, but Jo had seemed almost exhilarated when she found the faintest pulse, saying that she'd seen him do this before, begging them to move him somewhere warm, that he was alive. The doctor was alive! The door opened. Mike jumped slightly, suddenly realizing that he'd been on the verge of sleep.
That was quick, Joe, he said.
I only wanted to freshen up a bit, she replied, taking her place beside the doctor again. Brush my teeth. Any change? Mike shook his head.
The ice is all gone now, but nothing else as far as... Oh!
The doctor's eyes had snapped open.
Polypropylene,
he said, sitting up and swinging his legs off the bed.
Hello, Joe. Mike, where are we?
We're in a carpet factory, Joe explained. You were in one of your comas. I told them to bring you somewhere warm. The doctor smiled instantly, looking young again.
Yes, of course. I remember now,
he nodded.
That must have been at least 6 months ago. Tell me, what have I missed?
Joe gazed at him wide-eyed. But you were only in there for 4 minutes. The doctor frowned.
Fascinating. Oh, goodness me. I think I need a shave, don't you? And maybe a spot of breakfast? "6 months, you say?"
the brigadier repeated incredulously.
"At least, yes,"
the doctor nodded, spearing another sausage with relish.
"But where did you go, Doc?"
Benton asked, dipping his own sausage into a large pool of brown sauce.
"Well, that's just it, Sergeant,"
the doctor replied.
"Nowhere. I was completely unable to move, no matter how hard I tried. I was aging, as you saw."
"So all those poor passengers aged as well," Joe gasped.
"And died of malnutrition," the doctor added. "It was only because I was able to put myself into a coma that I didn't die or regenerate." "Thank heavens for small mercies," the brigadier said sardonically. "Three of you was quite enough." "Well then, the answer's obvious. The tunnel is a death trap. We must blow it up immediately." "You most certainly mustn't," the doctor protested. "I've already had the orders, I'm afraid," the brigadier announced. "Besides, what other option is there?"
"I go back in there on foot," the doctor replied, provoking a shocked protest from all three of them.
"Doctor, you can't," Joe begged him. "You know what happened last time you went in. If it happens again..."
The doctor leaned towards her.
"I've a feeling that the time anomaly was caused by the train going into whatever it was at speed. If I walk in, and especially from this end of the tunnel, I may well stand a better chance of observing it. Maybe doing something about it." "You have a feeling about whatever it was?" the brigadier scoffed. "I'm sorry, Doctor. I'm going to have to forbid you to go anywhere near that tunnel." "I'd like to see you try," the doctor smiled. "Half an hour, Brigadier. Give me half an hour."
"It'll take us at least an hour to set the explosives up," Benton offered, trying to be helpful.
"Yes, Benton, I'm perfectly aware of that,"
the brigadier bristled.
"Good,"
the doctor announced.
"I better get down there right away, then."
Joe tentatively stepped further into the tunnel. It was as if the darkness was folding itself around her. The air was musty and oddly warmer than outside. Wrong, somehow. Although she knew that the electricity had been turned off again, she couldn't help but press herself against the wall as she walked, for fear of touching the rails. Water occasionally dripped from the ceiling. Jo shuddered as a drop splashed onto her neck. It felt as if something in the tunnel was reaching down to touch her skin, warn her away. The only thing that she could see now was the light of the doctor's torch a few feet ahead of her, sweeping across the roof in time with his strident footsteps, picking out his comforting silhouette. And then it disappeared. Jo was about to shout out, to run ahead, when she saw a glimmer of torchlight again and realized that the doctor had simply rounded a bend in the tunnel. Sure enough, within a minute, she had done the same herself and gasped at what she saw. The doctor stood about 20 feet ahead, still silhouetted, but now by a shimmering wall of blue light that filled the tunnel ahead of him. His cloak flickered gently in a warm, slightly pungent breeze that seemed to be coming from the blue light. That smell! Jo recognized it from somewhere, but what was it? The doctor flicked off his torch as he stepped forward, entranced by the... What was it? A wall? A barrier? A doorway of some kind? If it was a doorway, the train had definitely passed through it. Perhaps into another dimension, or even another world. The doctor became aware of a sound, muffled and distant at first, but then, with every step forward, becoming closer, deeper, louder. The nearer he got to the blue light, the warmer the air became. The noise now so loud, it was almost deafening. Rain, thought Joe. It's the smell of rain before a storm. Yet more intense, almost sickening. And that terrible noise was like thunder. Jo cried out as the doctor stepped into the blue light and vanished. No! The blue light danced around him like a swarm of insects, humming and bouncing from wall to wall, leaping upwards, then suddenly diving towards the track, leaving a misty trail in its wake. It seemed almost alive. A few steps ahead, gleaming jewels appeared to be drifting slowly downwards from the ceiling. Fascinated, the doctor watched them explode on the floor at his feet, forming glistening crowns before shattering. He realized that they were droplets of water. As he had suspected, time was moving at a different rate here, slowing. The blue light vanished momentarily, and the doctor realized that it had slipped through a crack in the tunnel wall, one of several smaller crevices that had stretched outwards from a considerably larger one in the middle. It was like looking at a spider's web. The crevices seemed to stretch back far beyond the depths of the bricks. Was there a world beyond the wall, one inhabited by the blue lights? Were they, in fact, sentient? The swarm returned to the tunnel once again. The booming noise was so loud now that it was nearly unbearable. And worse, there was another sound. This one pitched higher, joining it and becoming louder itself, a deafening cacophony. The doctor noticed that his own body was now affected by the time distortion. His steps were taking longer, and even his breathing was slowing. He saw a trail of smoke snaking upwards out of his jacket pocket, curling into the blue light that continued to swarm from wall to wall, ceiling to floor. With a monumental effort, he forced his body to turn, battling against the onslaught of light, smoke and sound. Slowly, inch by inch, he waded back the way he had come. Joe cried out as the doctor stepped into the blue light and vanished, then gasped as he reappeared. Abandoning any pretense of not having followed him into the tunnel, she supported almost all his body weight as he staggered away from the blue light. It clung to him for a moment, almost as if it was trying to pull him back, then snapped away.
Joe,
the doctor whispered, exhausted from his effort.
What happened? Did the Brigadier blow up the entrance? Are we trapped here?
No, Doctor. We've only been down here for 2 minutes. The doctor looked confused for a moment and then rubbed the back of his neck thoughtfully.
Of course, he muttered. Joe, we need to stop him. Come on!
For someone who only a moment ago had looked like death warmed up, the doctor seemed remarkably sprightly as he raced towards the tunnel entrance. But then, that was the doctor all over. A mass of contradictions, maddening sometimes, baffling at others, but always a good man, and always so alive. Hang on a moment, Doctor. Wait for me!
Brigadier, you can't,
the doctor insisted.
Not until we know for sure exactly what's going on in that tunnel. Doctor, you've tried and failed, as I told you. I have my orders from Geneva, and there are nearly 300 corpses to prove that whatever it is in there is a dangerous threat. That threat must be trapped at the very least, and then, when we've got permission, destroyed.
You're going to blow up the hill? Joe asked.
Of course they're going to blow up the hill,
the doctor replied, his face contorted with rare anger.
It's the military's response to everything. Blow them up first, ask questions later.
He stormed out of the schoolroom and across the playground towards Bessie, scowling at Captain Yates and an apologetic-looking Benton as he did so. Joe ran after him, clambering into the passenger seat as he turned the ignition. For a moment, she thought he might be furious enough to drive Bessie down into the siding, onto the track and into the tunnel. But to her relief, he took a sharp turn to the left and up the hill. They skidded to a halt at the very top. The first streaks of sunrise were caressing purple clouds behind the Devil's Splinters, which towered above the village. Were they guarding it or planning its attack? Joe sniffed the air. Doctor, is there something wrong with Bessie? I can smell burning. The doctor shook his head and then glanced down at his jacket pocket, which had started to smoulder. He pulled out Joe's transistor radio and immediately dropped it. He felt his fingers throbbing beneath his driving glove. Irritated, he slapped his burning pocket, then carefully retrieved the radio from the floor. Cooler now, a small red light was flashing on its side. The doctor's eyes narrowed as he flicked a switch and it crackled into life. Just as he anticipated, they heard the deep booming noise from the tunnel, soon interrupted by the higher-pitched shriek. I heard that thunder sound in the tunnel, Joe said. The doctor nodded and flicked the switch again, silencing the device. Then he picked his sonic screwdriver up off the dashboard and, twisting its handle, lay it against the radio. It emitted a tiny whir, and they heard the noise again. Only this time, it was broken into 5 shorter explosions. The higher shriek barely lasted half a minute. The doctor repeated the process, and the sounds became even shorter. To her surprise, Jo realized that the shriek was her own desperate cry, and that the other sounds were words. 5 words. Help is on its way. The doctor looked up from the device and met Joe's gaze. As he did so, the explosions began again. The doctor stared out of the lab window into the deep blue sky. Joe recognized that look, but didn't completely understand the feelings behind it. She suspected it might have been something akin to the way she herself had felt during O-level maths lessons. One day, all this will be behind me.
So, what you're saying, she started, is that there was, or is, some sort of alien under that hill. An alien that crashed hundreds and hundreds of years ago, which is what caused those spooky rocks to be like that. It wasn't the devil breaking out of the hill so much as an alien spaceship crashing into it.
Most probably,
The doctor nodded, eyes still fixed on the sky. And this alien lives on a different time stream to us, doing everything at a slower rate than we do, so that if he'd sent out an SOS or whatever, we wouldn't be able to hear it, but his fellow aliens would, which is why they sent a message saying that help was on its way.
Yes, Joe, the doctor sighed.
And time slowing in the tunnel, that was just some sort of time leak coming out of the spaceship. If there is a spaceship. But why did it all happen now, not centuries ago?
We'll never know for sure, the doctor muttered. Not now that the Brigadier had the whole tunnel destroyed. At least not until...
He stopped and sighed again. Joe walked over and stood next to him, repeating softly. Not until...
Not until help arrives, Joe. But that might be in hundreds of years' time. I have a feeling I'll be... We'll be long gone by then.
His gaze wandered past her to the blue box in the corner of the lab, and Joe knew that her suspicions had been right. Time Tunnel by Nigel Fairs was read by Katie Manning and is a Big Finish production.